Welcome to the Hunger for Change podcast, the podcast where we debunk all the health myths that we have all been led to believe from the industry for so many, many years while talking to the most brilliant, innovative, and sometimes controversial minds in the health field. I'm your host, Niklas Gustafsson, and today I'm thrilled to introduce our special guest, Dr. Thomas J. Lewis. Dr. Lewis is an esteemed medical scientist who holds a PhD from MIT and Harvard Public Health. He is a renowned entrepreneur and healthcare professional. With his extensive knowledge and years of experience, he has dedicated his career to unraveling the mysteries of our bodies, the risks they face, and other determinants of health, physiology, pathology, and existing diseases. His continued mission is to replace the existing sick care approach with a new, true healthcare approach. So please join me welcoming Dr. Thomas J. Lewis to the show.
Thank you very much, Niklas, for the introduction. I'm looking forward to bring some of my insights to your followers.
Thank you so much for being here. So, Dr. Lewis, first of all, what does health mean to you and what brought you to this field?
You know, what's interesting about that question is on my website, health is the first of all liberties. If you don't have health, freedom doesn't matter. You have to be healthy. So this is something we all should be striving to achieve. The problem we have, particularly in America, but so many other developed nations have adopted the American system. I think COVID has shown that that's probably a mistake, is that doctors and the healthcare system don't measure health very accurately at all, if at all, in many cases. And sometimes they measure things that they think are indicative of bad health, but they're actually completely wrong about that. So This is a major problem. So give you a little bit more of my backstory. My father died of Alzheimer's about 20 years ago. And I met through my connections at Harvard and MIT, a very interesting doctor that was treating people just like my father 20 years ago and making them better. And the health system doesn't want you to hear about that because what they were doing is not expensive. Today we have expensive and failed drugs, expensive and failed procedures, and dangerous treatments that actually make you more vulnerable over the long term. Some are life-saving short term, but see, most diseases are chronic, not acute. Acute's an immediate problem. Chronic is long-term, slow, degrading health. 90% of disease, according to our own Centers for Disease Control, is chronic in nature. Yet when we go to the doctor, they very seldom focus on chronic issues. It's all about, how do you feel right now? How bad do you feel? And can I give you a drug or something to make you feel better? It has nothing to do with solving chronic issues.
I agree. So if we take a look at Alzheimer's disease, how would you explain it so that our listeners can understand what it really is?
Well, that's a great question, and not too far across the country of France from you is a lady in Switzerland who is the world number one expert on Alzheimer's disease. Her name is Judith Miklosi, M-I-K-L-O-S-S-Y, and she has been studying how Alzheimer's develops since she published a paper in 1993. She's an MD, PhD, brilliant woman. And she's worked with Harvard and collaborated all across the world. So basically, from what I learned from her and from my mentors at Harvard, there are really four legs to the stool that we have to pay attention to. The first one is your overall health, basically, because your brain is not sitting in isolation from the rest of your body. Last time I checked, mine's attached to the rest of my body. So we have to be considerate of everything that's going on in our whole body. So in that respect, the most important thing is making sure that your digestive system is working optimally. And I'll go into that a little later, probably give you some recommendations and tips that anybody can do from home today. Mm-hmm. But see, the gut is called the second brain or the enteric nervous system. You produce your neurotransmitters and your hormones, your regulatory hormones in your gut. Mm-hmm. And the brain is 10 times more metabolically active than the average of all the rest of your tissue in your body. So think of it. I have a heavy weight here and I'm curling it all day long. My bicep is eventually going to become fatigued from all that work. That's what your brain's doing every day. You sleep for your brain and your eyes because it just wears out, just like your bicep would if you were curling a weight all day long. So a lot of things pop up in the brain that don't pop up elsewhere because of the extraordinarily high energy demands of the brain. Secondly, so one is making sure your gut is very optimal. And I recommend a probiotic regimen for everybody, particularly in America, because we have such a lousy food supply. Hopefully Spain is better. I know France is better. That's why I'm going for a couple of weeks to eat some good food for a change.
Yeah.
But number two is making sure that you can downregulate or eliminate anything inflammatory, particularly in your brain. Your skull is a very confined space. If you bang your elbow really hard, it swells up with inflammation. Your brain can't do that because of the skull. So the brain has a very unique way of managing inflammation, which is sometimes in chronic disease like Alzheimer's, detrimental. In other words, inflammation can perpetuate in the brain. So there's a number of things we can do. You know, that's why just think about someone who's had a concussion.
Yeah.
It's a one-time insult like this, yet their brain may be dysfunctional for decades or the rest of their life. Why? Because there's perpetual inflammation going on in that brain. Okay, so we need to downregulate that. And there's a number of natural substances and even pharmaceuticals that will help cross the blood-brain barrier and calm down that fire. So curcumin is one. I think the most important ones are the fish oils. So for example, I eat a lot of fish, but I also will supplement with at least 15 grams every day of cod liver oil. Why cod liver oil rather than fish oil? Because cod liver oil it's fish oil, but it contains a lot more fat-soluble nutrients like vitamin A, like vitamin K, like vitamin E, like vitamin D in their natural form. So there's good research that shows after a concussion, even people that have been in coma, when they give very high doses of fish oil, preferably cod liver oil, they see some resolution. Other anti-inflammatories that have been proven to be effective in the brain is low-dose naltrexone. That is a pharmaceutical by prescription. It's it's taken at high doses for opioid addiction, overcoming opioid addiction. But at low dose, one-tenth the dose or less, it helps downregulate the inflammation that's occurring in what are called the microglial cells. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what Dr. McClosey showed is that spirochetal infections play a predominant role in the development of Alzheimer's and other dementias, not just Alzheimer's. So, what is a spirochete? In the US, we're familiar with the concept of Lyme disease, tick bite. So a tick bite with an infected tick can deliver into your bloodstream a type of bacteria that's called a spirochete. They're basically just spiral-shaped organisms, and they literally can drill into cells, cell walls, cell membranes, and get inside cells. Well, from my work, and I'm not a researcher, but I do quasi-clinical trial research work, is oral pathogens from root canals, cavitations, teeth that have been pulled, for example, wisdom teeth that are pulled in an improper manner and left a small pocket for bacteria to develop. This is the number one source of spirochetes that can get into the brain. And look at how close the teeth are to the brain and eyes. They're sitting right on top of each other. And that's what Dr. Mikulski did. She worked with the Foresight Harvard Medical School Dental Clinic for years, showing cause and effect. So Alzheimer's is famous for the so-called amyloid plaque. And what Dr. Mikulski showed is that dental infections, Lyme infections can induce this amyloid formation. And we now know, based on research at Harvard, that this process of the amyloid is not deleterious, it's protective. And within the last 6 months, there have been a number of papers and publications and news articles that the research blaming amyloid for Alzheimer's has been falsified over the last 20 years. So it's not even the right target. And the fourth pillar in Alzheimer's is making sure you have the right repair molecules in your system. And so in America, for many, many, many years, 50, 60 years, we've been pushing low-fat diets. Yeah. And every cell membrane, whether it's bone or a neuron or a red blood cell, is made of a phospholipid bilayer. Lipid simply means fat. It's a biological term, physiological term for fat. So really, every cell membrane in your body, including your neurons, are made of a phospho-fat bilayer. So high-fat diets, like the ketogenic diet, Mediterranean-style diet, focusing on good fats, these are really important building blocks that we need to rebuild brain cells. Now, there's an old myth that you're only born with so many brain cells and they start dying off. That's a completely false narrative. Yeah. At nighttime, you go to sleep, your brain quiets down, and that's when you can rebuild. You know, there was a brilliant study done by the BBC many, many years ago about British cab drivers before GPS. And they had an extremely enlarged hippocampus because they had to memorize all the back roads and streets of London. It's just proof that you can grow brain. You can expand the number of, and you can reestablish connections. Mm-hmm. In America, we have a program called Neurologics. It's an expensive system. It does brain mapping and then brain retraining, all more or less remotely. But it was developed by a NASA scientist and looks at 293 points of information transfer in the brain, and can literally reestablish connections. And one of the most prestigious doctors I know is the chief medical advisor to that organization. And not only can you somewhat effectively reverse dementias and cognitive impairment, but you can improve your IQ. He tells me at his tender age of 69 that his IQ has now returned to what it was when he was in medical school. Well, so that's kind of the Alzheimer's story, but looking for what I call these subacute infections, even though there's four pillars, you know, the gut, reducing inflammation, checking for infection that might have caused the inflammation and treating that, and then making sure you have the right repair systems in place. That's really what we want to do in most diseases.
And when you mentioned the, I mean, fortunately we see that the low fat diets, they are they're disappearing, right? And we're starting to replace them with healthier fats again. What would you say are the what sources of fat do you recommend?
So, in America, we have a lot of industrialized farming and GMOs, and I would say butter is right at the top of the list, but really, the fish oils and even some of the algae oils that contain DHA are some of the most important things you can take. So in the U.S., we have what's called the Omega Quant test, William Harris. And see, the Japanese outlive Americans by 7 years. And the Omega Quant test is just a measure of how much of the important marine-based fatty acids are attached to a red blood cell. Mm. And the Japanese are around 7 to 10%. Americans are around 4%. So okay. We are not eating enough fish or taking in enough fish oils. But yeah. Then, you know, I think diversity is really important. So hemp oil, flax seeds, avocado oil, walnuts are really good. A lot of certain types of nuts only, walnuts, pecans, macadamia nuts, really good for you. I think I already mentioned olive oil, coconut oil. Bruce Fife wrote a book called The Coconut Miracle. Well, it'll help with some people with their brain, not everybody, but it just proves that these fats are really important. The vegetable fats, I mean, it's really important to eat a lot of vegetables because you need the non-digestible fiber or carbohydrates to feed your gut microbiome. But those fats tend not to be as important for the brain. Good sure. for muscle, not for the brain. So we really want omega-3 and saturated fats.
Yeah.
Cheeses, for example, the French eat a lot of...
Yeah.
Like I try to eat as much of the European cheese as possible, like brie and other really fatty cheeses.
Yeah. When you mention vegetables, do you include fruits?
In that I look at fruit as a good source of vitamin C, a good source of liquid, and I think it's a good way to have dessert. So, I mean, fruits are important, but I almost never will eat fruit as a snack in isolation from another food because even though, junk food has fructose, fruit has fructose too, but it comes with, like Natasha Campbell McBride, that famous Russian doctors in England, says that at least when you eat a grape or a cherry, it comes with all the nutrients to help you digest.
Yeah. And the fibers as well.
Right. The fiber as well, you know. I mean, when I cook a pepper, I eat the whole daggum thing, seeds and everything. Yeah. And, you know, I'm trying to get as much fiber as I possibly can. So I think that's actually important. But, you know, when it comes to vegetables, particularly in the United States, where we have very poor digestion, you know, in my opinion, the single most important thing you are is not what you eat. We've heard that cliche, you are what you eat. It's not true. You are what you absorb. Okay. You are what you absorb. So if you eat well, but you absorb poorly, your inner physiology sees junk food.
Yeah.
So I have a few tips on digestion. Keep it, you know, so something people can do at home. The first thing is, unless you're convinced your digestion is excellent, avoid raw foods. And let me explain why. When we started moving north, it was because we harvested cooking. And there's a Harvard primatologist, someone who studies primitive cultures, that says we've been cooking for 500,000 years, roughly. When you cook a food, you make it easier to digest. That's why our gut is small compared to our brain. Whereas a cow has a big, huge four-compartment gut. You know, a hippopotamus has a huge gut and a little brain. Why? Because these animals are struggling to extract nutrients from raw foods.
From raw foods, yeah.
So does that mean don't eat a salad ever? No. But if you want to get, if you have any kind of illness or malady, if you want to get the most nutrients you can possibly get, gently cook your food. Compare a carrot, a hard, stiff carrot, compared to one that's been parboiled or sauteed in a nice butter and it's all softened. The fact that it's softened is really pre-digestion. It's the initial phase of digestion. So that's tip number one. Tip number two is try to include a little fermented food regularly. And you don't have to eat a large portion of, say, sauerkraut, just a little bit.
Yeah.
They have live cultures will help you inoculate your gut with these organisms. The third tip is the third tip is to start and or finish your meal with a warm, not a cold beverage.
A warm beverage.
A warm beverage or a hot beverage. So you only have 3.5 hours to liquefy anything you're going to digest. And the rate, your gut is basically just a chemical reactor, okay? And so, for example, if you have a dish with some hard grime on it, and you put it under cold water, or you put it under hot water, which one cleans better? The hot water.
Well, the hot water.
So that's basically
similar
to digestion. So the Japanese drink their miso soup, have their miso soup. The Europeans, you tell me, you're from Spain. Do you finish your meal with a hot tea or anything like that? Used to, you know.
I mean, tea or coffee is usually what you have at the end.
In America, every restaurant, even high-end restaurants, serve ice water.
It starts your
digestive off more slow, but your digestive process off more slowly. So, you know, the fourth tip is to take, because minerals are the hardest of all nutrients to extract from food.
To absorb.
Yet minerals are the most important micronutrients because they make enzymes carry out all these reactions. So right. I always recommend, when in doubt, take a fulvic humic liquid supplement. They're very inexpensive. And what that will do is it will give you pre-digested minerals. So if you're not digesting and breaking down these complex foods like kale and celery and asparagus and, you know, meats don't have a lot of minerals in them. It's the liver. You know, eat more liver, eat more offal. Europeans eat a lot more offal than U.S., but I try to eat liver on a regular basis. Not a lot, just, you know, some, because it's so high in nutrient density. But, you know, but in lieu of that, you know, at the top of the nutrient density list, those that have the greatest micronutrients.
Yeah.
Liver, organ meats. Second will be herbs and spices, things of that nature. So very important, you know, to spice up your food as well. It's not just for flavor. It's really to get extra micronutrients. Nuts and seeds are also very high in micronutrient density.
I agree. Actually, I had calf's liver for lunch today. Was great. Grass-fed calf's liver.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I'm thawing out some chicken liver, and my favorite liver is duck liver. And, you know, duck fat is extremely good. Like, I'll roast ducks once in a while, and then I'll just decant off or filter off the fat.
The fat. I do as well. That's amazing. So if you would have to list the major causes of Alzheimer's so that our audience can avoid them, what would they be?
Well, you know, I think in America, 15 million root canals are done every year. And all root canals fail. And the definition of failure is to become infected and you don't even know it because there's no longer nerve or blood supply to that area. So the spirochetes from root canals are a major contributor. We can see a tremendous uptick in Alzheimer's with a tremendous upkick in these fancy dental procedures that save teeth.
Yeah.
You know, a podiatrist does not keep a gangrenous toe on your foot. Yet we're keeping literally a gangrenous tooth in your mouth. My daughter, 36 years old, had two root canals removed at my recommendation. Don't know why she got them. I never heard why, but she got them. And one, the dentist cracked the tooth while extracting it, and it let off an awful stench. It was septic. It was infected. She had no symptoms, no signs, no knowledge of it. 36 years old and healthy. So what do you think a 75-year-old with some cognitive impairment and two or three root canals has going on? Yeah. So that's really the driver. And then the high-fat diet, the high anti-inflammatory diet. But the third thing that you need to get tested.
Yeah.
Very important to look at what your innate immune system is doing. And that's simply your white blood cell counts. And see, the standard of care has a range like this for white blood cell counts. And your doctor will very quickly say, oh, you're fine. But see, Alzheimer's, you don't catch Alzheimer's. It slowly smolders. And then suddenly symptoms start erupting maybe 20 years later. My white blood cell counts that I think is optimal to avoid Alzheimer's is a very narrow range. The number would be 4,000. I mean, I know in Europe they use different units, but in the US it would be 4,000 counts per microliter to 5,700 counts per microliter. Just to give you an idea, in the United States, 3,500 to 11,000 is considered normal. That's completely wrong. And that's why people get Alzheimer's suddenly, and everybody says, where'd that come from? It's been developing, and the white blood cell counts are giving you that clue. I had a lady just that I did a consult with this morning. Her white blood cell counts are 6,300. I want them to be between 4,000 and 5,700. She's 52 years old and thinks she has some inflammation in her vessels. And so we're going to test for oral pathogens. We're going to test for things like chlamydia pneumoniae. Have you ever heard of that organism?
No.
So it sounds like the STD, but it's not. Chlamydia pneumoniae. So it's spelled like pneumonia, but I-A-E. And it's very easy to look that up. Look up chlamydia pneumoniae and Alzheimer's disease. And in the top of your hit list will be a PhD by the name of Brian Balin from the Osteopathic Institute of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And he, along with Dr. McClosey, have done the landmark work to show that chlamydia pneumoniae infection, or at least the laboratory antibodies against that organism, are present in a large percentage of Alzheimer's and dementia patients. And once again, you don't feel, you don't have a cough. You don't have pneumonia. The most you might have is, you know, a little intermittent fatigue or something like that. Then the next thing you know, you can't remember where you put your keys, or you can't remember a name you heard recently. You can remember older names, but you know, you can't remember your grandkid's name or something like that. And I'm one of the few people, I test chlamydia pneumoniae in everybody because it is ubiquitous. It's very, very common. I would say oral infection is the most common cause of infection that can get in the brain. Chlamydia pneumoniae is second, then things like mycoplasma are probably third. There's a lady in in England. I'll probably pronounce her name wrong, but her name is Ruth Itziaka, I think. And she has done the landmark work on the connection between viruses and Alzheimer's disease beyond any reasonable doubt. But see, it's not about the virus. It's not about chlamydia pneumonia. It's not about the oral spirochetes. It's about making sure your terrain is as healthy as it can possibly be, so these things never can take hold. It's like starting a fire. You know, you want that, when it comes to disease, you want that starter paper to be wet with health, not dry and ready to burn. And it's that simple, because once the fire starts, it's a lot harder to put out an existing fire than it is to prevent a fire from starting in the first place.
So I was listening to this podcast with Dr. McCullough, and you were explaining that glaucoma is like the Alzheimer's of the eye, and Alzheimer's being the glaucoma of the brain. And I found this extremely interesting. Would you mind expanding on that?
Well, I mean, you said it perfectly, and that's all it is. See, the eye, earlier I was explaining that the brain is 10 times more metabolically active than any other tissue in the body. I told a minor white lie there, or maybe I didn't, because the retina is actually part of the brain. It's an outcropping. There's a chaired professor at Harvard Medical School, John Dowling, who wrote a very detailed book. Lay people can read it, but it's really a textbook called The Retina, the Approachable Part of the Brain. Okay. So really, glaucoma is a disease, a degenerative disease of the retina. Alzheimer's is a degenerative disease of the brain. Frontal temporal dementia is a degenerative disease of the frontal temporal region. You know, so these were well defined by Charles Mayo, the founder of the Mayo Clinic, who described what's called a focal or localized infection. So in other words, when you have arthritis and you're just these two joints are swollen, but these two aren't, you most likely have a focal or localized inflammatory or infectious process going on there. Why can't you have a focal or localized disease in the eye? And in fact, my mentor showed that you only have one brain, but you have two eyes. And very often, glaucoma can start in one eye and then migrate to what's called the fellow eye. And we can tell this with great accuracy using a standard instrument called optical coherence tomography, which measures the retinal nerve very precisely. So this whole concept of focal means you can get glaucoma and not get dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, because it's localized to the eye. But very often, since the tissue is all connected across the blood-brain barrier, it's possible for the whatever's causing this pathology to migrate to different parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. So my dad had glaucoma 10 years before his Alzheimer's diagnosis.
Really?
I was just my grandfather, he had glaucoma. My mother had glaucoma. And I made this 23andMe gene test saying that I do have a risk of getting glaucoma when getting older. So I'm so that's why I'm also like personally interested in how to avoid, you know, at least lowering the risk of getting glaucoma.
I have a different view on those genetic tests. You know, we're not, you and me, we're 99.9% the same genetically. And I know there are some alleles, but the alleles differences do not cause a disease. They might make you just a little bit more susceptible to a pathway. So it's not a death, life or death sentence. I don't even check my alleles. I don't bother checking it because my goal is to keep myself healthy, not to worry about some epigenetic predisposition. So I've heard in the past that the APOE4 double four is deleterious to glaucoma and Alzheimer's, but protective to macular degeneration. That makes no sense to me because the disease process in my world and in my partner's world in Harvard are the same disease process. You know, the APOE4 has been shown to be protective in malaria. You know, there's never, I mean, if we had these alleles that were absolutely detrimental to us, we wouldn't survive, you know? So I think they can be interesting. Like people talk about, you know, my diet for a blood type. What were people eating three generations ago when they didn't know blood type?
No.
You know, yeah, we survived as a species.
Yeah. So
a lot of these things, you know, I have functional doctors on my team, and they do the genetic testing and the alleles and all the power to them. God bless them. They can do that. I don't. I look at your terrain with a fine tooth comb and work on that. Not on things like, if you have the double four allele, what's your treatment? What do you do?
Yeah.
Sit around and worry that you're predisposed to something and it's a hopeless situation. I don't go down that way. I say be four things. More Japanese, eat more seafood, more sea vegetables, more iodine, you know, good, you know, nice warm soups with your meal. Be more Korean. They're seeing the greatest increase in longevity, and they eat the widest variety of fermented foods. Good for the gut, good for your whole body. Be more Asian Indian, because they eat the most herbs and spices. So they're getting, independent of the offal, the organ meats, they're getting a lot of micronutrients. Mm. And the last one I tell you to be is more Jamaican. Don't worry, be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Because stress, concern, and worry about the future.
Yeah. Raises your cortisol levels, makes you more.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's called fight or flight. I call it thrive versus survive. If you're, you know, challenges are good. Like I challenge my brain, I challenge my arm, you know, a bit, and it gets stronger. But the stress, like I challenge my arm all day long and then it goes into tremor, that's not accomplishing anything. So, you know, that is a key mechanism of disease. So I always say, don't worry. I mean, it's kind of hard to avoid in our crazy globe to these things that we feel it's out of our control. So what I say you do, the best way to solve that is to make a list of things that are in your control.
Yeah.
And do your best with those.
So what about physical activity and sun exposure when it comes to preventing Alzheimer's?
So that's really a great question. And, you know, I just finished writing a 2-volume set that I haven't published yet called Health Freedom Lost. And I spent a lot of time. The very last chapter I wrote is on energy medicine. And it's quite extraordinary what sunlight does. But see, we are programmed for instantaneous gratification. I don't feel well. I want to go out in the sunshine and sunbathe for a half hour and come back in and feel great. No, we need sun exposure every day. We need the ground every day. We need to be exposed to the outside environment to pick up organisms that repopulate our microbiome through our saliva, things of that nature. But there's a gentleman, there's a great talk by Roger Schwelt on MedCram, who summarized the work of, I don't remember his first name, but his name is Zimmerman, who explained, see, when you go out in the sun and your skin darkens up a little bit, because it's absorbing light. But it turns out that we have what are called chromophores throughout our body, and they're doing work for us. And the most important chromophores are inside our cells in our energy plants called mitochondria. So what sunlight does is the whole purpose of the mitochondria is to take carbohydrates and oxygen and convert it to carbon dioxide and water. And that's what we call a downhill reaction. It releases energy. That's what we want. That's what our mitochondria do.
Mm.
But so there's electrons transporting down that chain. But there's a lot of things that want to steal our electrons. See, electrons inside the mitochondria is our currency. It's our money. It's our euro. It's our US dollar. It's our gold bullion, whatever you want to call it. And there's always things around that want to steal our money. in our cells, there are things that want to steal our electrons. What sunlight does is it provides electrons, and it creates this cycle of renewing what's called the Krebs cycle, this electron transport chain. So we always have a sufficiency of electrons. And like, for example, NAD gets a lot of play. But there's NAD and NAD plus. In order for NAD to work, we got to convert the NAD plus back to NAD. What does that? An electron. Where might that electron come from? Sunshine impinging on melatonin and cytochrome C oxidase. So cytochrome C, so cyto, cellular, chrome, chromophore. So in other words, cytochrome C is something that can absorb light and keep our electron transport chain working. Maybe it's a little complicated, but the bottom line is go out and get some sunshine. And, you know, there's a lot of studies that say, oh, you go out and you might get melanoma. That's not true.
So why are we being told that we should stay out of the sun, always use sunscreen when it's sunny? Why are we being told that?
Well, it's the same group that told us to eat low fat.
Right.
It's the same group that told us that pharmaceutical drugs are better for us than, you know, natural vitamin D and things of that nature. You know, if you look at the good studies, you will see that even if you've had a sunburn, your likelihood of getting melanoma does not go up. In fact, it might even go down. So squamous and basal cells, you know, are something you want to avoid, and how you avoid them is going out in the sun gradually, starting in, if you're in Europe, start early, totally. Take the shirt off, take the shoes off, go out there. I'm a freak around my neighborhood because I ride my bike without a shirt, and everybody's like, look at that crazy guy going without his shirt. But melanoma is cancer of the melanocytes. It's not a skin cancer. Now, there happens to be a lot of melanocytes in the skin, but there are melanocytes in other in the testes, I think in the uterus, like in the eyes. So like, you know, you can get melanoma with no sun exposure.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're much more likely to not get melanoma if you get out in the sun and you produce natural vitamin D and activate your Krebs cycle with red and near infrared light. That keeps your electron transport chain, your energy chain, working in your cells. Look, basically, everything we've been told, that the major things, low fat, stay out of the sun, starve yourself. I mean, none of them have proven to be right, but the thing is, they are etched in the standard of care. And it's like turning the Titanic. The Titanic saw the iceberg. But it's such a big, unwieldy ship, it couldn't turn in time. That's our medical system.
I know. And usually there is an industry behind this. There are economic interests behind making a lot of money. And but thank you so much for clarifying that with the sun, because I do believe that too many of us, they stayed out of the sun. They're just scared of being in the sun. And they use sunscreen all the time. So
there's a way Dr. Zimmerman in his presentation said there is a way to go out and get some sun if you're afraid of the sun.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is go in shade and you still get some reflective infrared.
Sure.
So if you're totally reticent to go out in the sun, at least go out in the shade with no sunscreen and you'll still get some sun.
Exactly.
Yeah. But if you want to produce vitamin D in its natural form, you've got to get the UV. You've got to get UV doesn't reflect like the infrared does.
So, Dr. Lewis, could you tell us more about the concept of sick care versus health care? And why do you believe there need to be a shift in focus in the medical field?
Well, you know, Let me ask you a simple question. Do you want to be, you know, I call it the standard of health versus the standard of care. It's called the standard of care that we get. Do you want care or do you want health? It's that simple. So yeah. In our coding system in the United States, it's called ICD-10. And I know everybody else uses something similar to that. There are 68,000 diagnostic codes. That's a ridiculous number. And it is there. Everything is a disease. And you cannot get a proper blood test unless you already have a diagnosis. In other words, we have the cart before the horse. Yeah. You cannot get good testing until you're already sick. That is in the code, except for a very narrow set of panels like A1C chemistry and then your lipids, and then they interpret the cholesterol completely wrong. Let me give you an example, because I have a very different view, which, by the way, I believe is the right view. And I've written a lot about it. And I have 4 1-hour long videos on lipids, cholesterol, and statin drugs. So I'm going to ask a very provocative question. How many people on this planet know what their cholesterol number is? The answer is zero.
I listened actually to one of your podcasts when you're talking about free cholesterol. Is that why? Is that the answer?
We don't measure free cholesterol.
Right.
What you're told is called TC, total cholesterol.
Yeah.
So what's total cholesterol? Exactly. It's your low density lipoprotein, LDL, plus your high density lipoprotein, HDL, plus 20% of your triglycerides. Where's the free cholesterol molecule in that calculation?
So you don't measure. You don't measure the free cholesterol.
It's the most demonized molecule in medicine. Yet I called up Boston Heart Labs, Cleveland Heart Labs, and I said, can I get my actual cholesterol molecule tested? And the first lady very politely said, oh, yeah, we do a total cholesterol test. I said, no, ma'am. The sterol molecule called cholesterol. Because you can measure it. I'm a chemist. We measure that stuff. I said, can I please talk to a chemist at your facility? I never got a call back. So what is your blood composed of? Water. 92% water and then a bunch of stuff flowing through it, cells and whatnot. Have you ever made salad dressing? When you don't shake it up, the oil rises to the top, less dense, and the water to the bottom. So how do you get fats? Remember, every cell in your body, phospholipid bilayer, your brain is 60, 65% fat. How do we get their fats up there? Are we injecting fats into our brain? No, they're traveling through our bloodstream. They're traveling through fats, not just the cholesterol molecule, which is extremely important. But anything fat soluble, saturated fats, vitamin D is a fat soluble, vitamin A is a fat soluble, vitamin E is a fat soluble, vitamin K is a fat soluble, EPA is a fat soluble, DHA is a fat soluble. They are not free floating in your bloodstream. So here's the analogy. You have a greasy dish and you want to clean it for the next meal. And you put it underwater. Then when you touch it, is it still greasy? You just put it underwater. Absolutely, it's still greasy.
Yes.
Then you put this magic substance in the water called soap. And suddenly the grease disappears. Where'd it go? It just got packaged up in little soap spheres to travel through the water. That's all LDL is. The most demonized substance is LDL, called the bad cholesterol. It's not a cholesterol whatsoever. It's low-density lipoprotein. It is simply a soap molecule. It's all it is. Its structure is exactly the same as soap. And so LDL carries fats to our tissue. So if you're under repair, if you're diseased, LDL, of course, is going to go up because it's bringing healing lipids and fats to the area of damage. And HDL, if you're taking in excess fats, not in a bad way, but just more than your body needs at this moment, will go up and recycle those fats back through the digestive tract, through the liver and kidneys. So yeah. I look at LDL and HDL as just, are you fat sufficient or not? I use a biomarker called the atherogenic index of plasma, which is just the ratio of triglycerides to HDL, the log of it. But see, triglycerides is a reflection of your sugars, and HDL is a reflection of your fats. So the smaller that number, the smaller your sugar and the more the fats, the healthier you are. And this is by Johns Hopkins, Mayo Clinic.
Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, if I compare what I eat today to what I ate 15 years ago, you know, I was 15 years ago, I was having oatmeal in the morning. I was having potato, rice. And today I eat more fish, more meat. My energy comes from fat. And if I compare my cholesterol levels today, they're much higher. But I mean, that's what it should be, because my energy comes from fat, so my fat needs to be circulating around in my bloodstream, right? So I don't see it as a problem.
No, it's part of it. You want to have, like, if you cut yourself, you want to have Band-Aids in your medicine cabinet. That's what the fats are. They're Band-Aids,
right? Yeah.
So, can I share screen for a second?
Of course.
You know, I actually have a whole slide deck, but I'll just show. Let me see if I can find it. This should be in. There's a paper on. Here we are. Paper published in Nature magazine, one of the top three journals, science journals of all time. And I'll just do a quick screen share here.
Sure.
And so it was measured in the Korean population because they have an excellent healthcare system. But on the left-hand side is the hazard ratio of dying young. And the more we go up here, the more likely you are to die young. And here is your total cholesterol number, okay? And so Let's just pick an age category. We'll pick 45 to 54 year olds, okay? Big number of people. So you can see right here between 200 and 265, very low mortality risk. But if you go where the American College of Cardiology wants you to be out here, right, you're a man, bring your total cholesterol down to 140, here you've increased your risk of dying young by 50%.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
And so on and so forth. The only people it doesn't make that much difference for are 18 to 34 year olds, whereas they have low risk pretty much everywhere. But if you can see that you want to be between 180 and 250, and the older you get, like here's 75 to 99 year old, you want to be between 180 and 280.
Yeah.
And most doctors are going to be putting you on a statin drug at that point, which is completely wrong. You know, statin drugs are off patent, so they don't make a lot of money on them. But over the course of the use of statins since they were introduced in 1987, gross revenues from statin drugs to lower cholesterol, $1 trillion.
Yeah.
But see, today, even though they're generic, they're still making the drug companies a lot of money, because there's a big increase in diabetes when you're on a statin drug. So then the drug companies can prescribe insulin. There's a big increase in heart failure because it lowers CoQ10 production. So the heart failure drugs,
exactly,
like Entresto, are very, very expensive. So, and then they'll find, and if you have things like autoimmune conditions, that psoriasis and things like that, you don't have enough fats in circulation. I'm sure these these statin drugs are contributing to that as well. And so therefore you're taking the biologic drugs, very expensive.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
Yeah, it's a mess. So because we're running out of time, so to wrap this up, what do you see, what do you envision, I mean, the future of healthcare? What does it look like to you?
So we do have to, in order to make change, we do have to take that Titanic and completely turn that ship around. And that's not going to be easy. But I am working with a health insurance group in the United States, an emerging one. It's been work. They've been trying to launch now for about 15 years. They finally launched. And life insurance companies. What's interesting is the objective of a life insurance company for an individual is 180 degrees opposite than a health insurance company. A life insurance company wants you to live to 100. A health insurance company wants you to live to 80. Why? When you live to 80, you have 19 years of declining health. That's very expensive. When you live to 100, you tend to fall off the cliff. You only have 9 years of declining health on average. So I'm working with a life insurance group. But the only way we're going to win this war, Nicholas, is with an evidence-based system. And what I've built, a little self-serving, I'm patting myself on the back here a little bit, but when you look at blood-based biomarkers, they are the most objective things in terms of measuring your health. It's not like a survey or some scan. The blood, your blood doesn't lie. So 10 years ago, and I'm still working at it, I developed a completely different scale for measuring health and disease. And I call it, where do you lie on the health disease continuum? And with my scale based on mortality risk, I can place anybody in anywhere on the globe as to where they lie on the health disease continuum. Now, a diagnosis is an artificial spot on that point, on that line. And what I'm working on is trying to herd functional, integrative, and alternative doctors to establish a single platform and work together, just like the standard of care is coerced to work together for financial and many other reasons, threat to the license, whatever. But if we're going to be successful, we can't just have expensive concierge functional medicine. We have to have low cost, highly available, but evidence-based practices that will help, that is defensible. So I can't have some doctor from the American Heart Association telling me I'm wrong about cholesterol when I can show them data like this Korean study that shows them that they're wrong. Objective data. And so that's the rest of my life mission. Pray for me that I live a long life, because it's going to take a long time to do this. But I'm starting we're starting to get a lot of people creating this parallel health system, and we need to bring them all together into the fold. And if we do that, then we'll have some tugboats that can start pushing that Titanic in the other direction.
Right. So, Dr. Lewis, I'm sure that our listeners, they want to follow your work. Where can they find you?
So, you know, my main website, right over my shoulder here, healthrevivalpartners.com. And just so you know, probably in a couple months, we are launching a very sophisticated upgrade in our system that is a very detailed risk assessment. And in my opinion, based on publications I've done, if you answer this risk assessment honestly, you don't need labs, or at least initially. I can help you correct health problems just by the way you answer a risk assessment. It'll take you about 45 minutes to complete. And the system automatically spits out recommendations based on your answers. And in my opinion, if we can just get people evaluating the risks in their lives and start correcting that, we'll have a healthier society. And in fact, I published a paper that showed that this is true.
Yeah.
So your audience,
I believe you're right.
Whether you're in the US or anywhere, you know, want to contact us, info@healthrevivalpartners.com. And when we launched that program in a couple months, I would invite folks to just take that survey and see what we find in terms of our view on your health. We give you a risk score and everything to help motivate you and understand where your key weak points are that you should be working on.
Do you work with patients, clients outside the US?
Oh yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
Great. Sometimes they have labs and they'll send me their labs. Sometimes I just have them take the risk assessment.
Mm. Mm.
And we do an interview. So yeah, I mean, you know, like if someone has dementia, for example, my main expertise, but I can get them on the right track. But see, the survey gives me a lot of details as to, see, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, we have to start taking out those straws. It's we can't take off the entire, you know, satchel.
Straws,
but we can start removing straws, and that's better than not.
Of course, we will link your webpage, by the way, to this episode, so people can find it there.
Appreciate it. Love to get a copy if you can do that too.
Dr. Lewis, I really appreciate your time. It was really interesting to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Hunger for Change podcast. I also wanted to take a moment to talk about Naturally, my brand of healthy food products. At Naturally, we are on a mission to change the world through what we eat. This is why we worked so hard to make products that are delicious and also good for you. They're all gluten-free and have no refined sugar. My personal favorites are the cheesy snacks, chocolates, and cacao hazelnut spread. We also have kale chips, granolas, nut bars, nut butters, and protein powders, as well as many cool snacks to be released this year. At the moment, Naturally is only available in Europe. You can head over to our website, naturally.com, and it will take you to our online store. If you're in Italy, Portugal, Germany, Poland, France, the Netherlands, or Sweden, you can find them in Amazon. Search for Naturally. I will leave all of these links in the description anyway, so that you can find them. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.